copper has been exploited for health purposes since ancient times to reduce the spread of germs and cure infections. Copper workers in Paris were protected from several cholera epidemics, and French wineries applied copper sulfate and slaked lime, called Bordeaux mixture, to vines to prevent fungal attack. Fantasylandia in Chile, one of Latin America's largest theme parks, has replaced its most frequently touched surfaces with copper to help reduce the spread of germs and protect the health of its visitors. Copper and its alloys exhibit impressive antibacterial, antiviral, and antifungal properties. Now that we are faced with the global spread of coronavirus, copper may be an important tool in slowing down the virus. While the SARS-CoV-2 virus endures for days on plastic or metal, it disintegrates soon after landing on copper surfaces. In our first article, which comes from the Smithsonian, we will learn about why copper is so effective this way, and more about the way it is being used now. This is titled, Copper's Virus-Killing Powers Were Known Even to the Ancients, and written by Jim Morrison, published on April 14, 2020. When researchers reported last month that the novel coronavirus causing the COVID-19 pandemic survives for days on glass and stainless steel, but dies within hours after landing on copper, the only thing that surprised Bill Keevil was that the pathogen lasted so long on copper. Keevil, a microbiology researcher at the University of Southampton, UK, has studied the antimicrobial effects of copper for more than two decades. He has watched in his laboratory as the simple metal slew one bad bug after another. He began with the bacteria that causes Legionnaire's disease, and then turned to drug-resistant killer infections like methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, MRSA or MRSA. He tested viruses that caused worldwide health scares, such as Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, MERS, and the swine flu H1N1 pandemic of 2009. In each case, copper contact killed the pathogen within minutes. It just blew it apart, he says. In 2015, Keevil turned his attention to coronavirus 229E, a relative of the COVID-19 virus that causes the common cold and pneumonia. Once again, copper zapped the virus within minutes while it remained infectious for 5 days on surfaces such as stainless steel or glass. One of the ironies is people install stainless steel because it seems clean, and in a way it is, he says, noting the material's ubiquity in public places. But then the argument is, how often do you clean? We don't clean often enough. Copper, by contrast, disinfects merely by being there. Keevil's work is a modern confirmation of an ancient remedy. For thousands of years, long before they knew about germs or viruses, people have known of copper's disinfectant powers. Copper is truly a gift from Mother Nature, in that the human race has been using it for over 8 millennia, says Michael G. Schmidt, a professor of microbiology and immunology at the Medical University of South Carolina, who researches copper in healthcare settings. The first recorded use of copper as an infection-killing agent comes from Smith's papyrus, the oldest known medical document in history. The information therein has been ascribed to an Egyptian doctor circa 1700 BC, but is based on information that dates back as far as 3200 BC. Egyptians designated the Ankh symbol, representing eternal life, to denote copper in hieroglyphs. As far back as 1600 BC, the Chinese used copper coins as medication to treat heart and stomach pain, as well as bladder diseases. The seafaring Phoenicians inserted shavings from their bronze swords into battle wounds to prevent infection. For thousands of years, women have known that their children didn't get diarrhea as frequently when they drank from copper vessels and passed on this knowledge to subsequent generations. You don't need a medical degree to diagnose diarrhea, Schmidt says. And copper's power lasts. Keevil's team checked the old railings at New York City's Grand Central Terminal a few years ago. The copper is still working, just like it did the day it was put in over 100 years ago, he says. This stuff is durable, and the antimicrobial effect doesn't go away. What the ancients knew, modern scientists and organizations such as the Environmental Protection Agency have confirmed. The EPA has registered about 400 copper surfaces as antimicrobial. But how exactly does it work? Heavy metals, including gold and silver, are antibacterial, but copper's specific atomic makeup gives it extra killing power, Keevil says. Copper has a free electron in its outer orbital shell of electrons that easily takes part in oxidation reduction reactions, which also makes the metal a good conductor. As a result, Schmidt says, it becomes a molecular oxygen grenade. Silver and gold don't have the free electron, so they are less reactive. Copper kills in other ways as well, according to Keevil, who has published papers on the effect. When a microbe lands on copper, ions blast the pathogen like an onslaught of missiles, preventing cell respiration and punching holes in the cell membrane or viral coating and creating free radicals that accelerate the kill, especially on dry surfaces. Most importantly, the ions seek and destroy the DNA and RNA inside a bacteria or virus, preventing the mutations that create drug-resistant superbugs. The properties never wear off, even if it tarnishes, Schmidt says. Schmidt has focused his research on the question of whether using copper alloys in often touched surfaces reduces hospital infections. On any given day, about 1 in 31 hospital patients has at least one healthcare-associated infection, according to the Centers for Disease Control, costing as much as $50,000 per patient. Schmidt's landmark study, funded by the Department of Defense, looked at copper alloys on surfaces including bedside rails, tray tables, intravenous poles, and chair armrests at three hospitals around the country. That 43-month investigation revealed a 58% infection reduction compared to routine infection protocols. Further research stalled when the DoD focused on the Zika epidemic, so Schmidt turned his attention to working with a manufacturer that created a copper hospital bed. A 2-year study published early this year compared beds in an intensive care unit with plastic surfaces and those with copper. Bed rails on the plastic surfaces exceeded the accepted risk standards in nearly 90% of the samples, while the rails on the copper bed exceeded those standards on only 9%. We again demonstrated in spades that copper can keep the built environment clean from microorganisms, he says. Schmidt is also a co-author of an 18-month study led by Shannon Hintze-Leisure, an environmental microbiologist at Grinnell College, that compared the bacterial abundance in occupied and unoccupied rooms at Grinnell Region Medical Center's 49-bed rural hospital. Again, copper reduced bacterial numbers. If you're using a copper alloy that's always working, Hintze-Leisure says, you still need to clean the environment, but you have something in place that's working all the time to disinfect as well. Keevil and Schmidt have found that installing copper on just 10% of surfaces would prevent infections and save $1,176 a day, comparing the reduced cost of treating infections to the cost of installing copper. Yet hospitals have been slow to respond. I've been surprised how slow it has been to be taken up by hospitals, Hintze-Leisure adds. A lot of it has to do with our healthcare system and funding to hospitals, which is very tight. When our hospital redid our emergency room, we installed copper alloys in key places. So it makes a lot of sense when you're doing a renovation or building something that's new. It's more expensive if you're just changing something that you already have. The Centara Hospital System in North Carolina and Virginia made copper-impregnated surfaces the standard across 13 hospitals in 2017 for overbed tables and bed rails after a 2016 clinical trial at a Virginia Beach hospital reported a 98% reduction in drug-resistant organisms. Using technology pioneered in Israel, the hospital has also moved to copper-infused bedding. Kievel says France and Poland are beginning to put copper alloys in hospitals. In Peru and Chile, which produce copper, it's being used in hospitals and the public transit systems. So it's going around the world, but it still hasn't taken off, he says. If copper kills COVID-19, should you periodically roll a few pennies and nickels around in your hands? Stick with water, soap, and sanitizer. You never know how many viruses are affiliated with the hand, so it may not completely get them all, Schmidt says. It will only be a guess if copper will completely protect. Now, there are definitely days when I would love not to hear the word coronavirus. Understandably, it is the focus of our attention, but it can be overwhelming at times. So I hope that you'll agree with me that the articles we're going to read today that relate to COVID-19 are helpful and offer some tips for coping while we muddle our way through this. I love the title of the first article, "So You Had a Bad Day, ... which offers some specific tips for making a bad day better. And the second article gives advice on how to support friends and family who were on the front lines of the pandemic. This first article titled, "So You Had a Bad Day," comes from the New York Times, written by Jen A. Miller and published on May 12, 2020. It was the tail end of a long day of small, stupid things that in normal times would have been tiny grains of sand to knock out of my shoe. But on that day, another pandemic day in a long string of pandemic days, those small, gritty things, the dog wanted too much attention, work was causing stress, the neighbor's kid was outside screaming again, became boulders. But I set those things aside, I thought, and got ready to do a teleseminar for a few hundred strangers. And then my recycling blew down the street. "I can't take it anymore," I shouted from the middle of the road while chasing boxes and newspapers. It's not uncommon for the small to become the insurmountable right now. There's a lot more coming at us and fewer ways to discharge it than ever, said Seth G. Gillihan, PhD, Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of Pennsylvania, and co-author of A Mindful Year, 365 Ways to Find Connection and the Sacred in Everyday Life. A lot of us are taking on more than we can really process in real time and more than our nervous systems can digest. Your nervous system is in overload, so it's no wonder you don't know what you're feeling anymore. This is called experiential blindness, said Lisa Feldman Barrett, PhD, professor of psychology at Northeastern University and author of How Emotions Are Made. Essentially, our brain takes cues from what our body is doing at any moment. If our heart rate goes up, the brain parses info about whether we're running from a lion or merely walking up the stairs. From there, the brain reacts, often in the form of emotions. However, we rely on our memories to tell us that indeed this is the drab flight of stairs to our walk-up. Most of us, however, have never been through a global pandemic. There are no previous memories for our brain to draw on. Hence, my shouting in the middle of the street about a crushed beer can blowing in the wind. Remember, however, that you don't have to stay in that awful place for good. You can rebound. Here's how. Breathe. As cliched as it sounds, stopping to take a breath can snap you out of your mood. When you are feeling your worst, stop and take 2 minutes to inhale and exhale deeply, said Alexandra L., a wellness consultant and author of Today I Affirm, a journal that nurtures self-care. Doing this kind of breathing helps her remember to be in the moment and to be present with whatever is in front of me, behind me, and what's to come, she said. Dr. Barrett says she tries to either consciously reason out exactly what she might be feeling and why, or I take a more Buddhist approach and think, okay, I'm feeling something. I'm just going to sit with it and let it wash over me, she said. You don't have to retreat to a special place to do this, whether you need this breath now or later. We're not all sit on a pillow and meditate type folks, said Mrs. L. Wherever you are works just fine, though maybe for your own safety, get out of the middle of the street first. It's fine just to take some time to think about what is happening and how you feel. Just be aware that constant rumination or getting stuck in negative thoughts may be a sign that it's time to reach out to a mental health professional. Apologize. If your blow-up involved another person, simply apologize. And after apologizing, try to tell the other person what happened. Not to justify it, but to explain it, said Philip Levy, PhD, family therapist and co-author of The Resilient Couple Navigating Together Through Life. Then discuss with the other person, what did we learn from it, and what can we do differently moving forward? Talk about what you need from the other person, especially if they did something well-intentioned, like interrupted your work to tell you that a delivery had arrived, or spent way more than you had budgeted for groceries. It's important for you to be able to try to listen and not get into whether you're right or wrong or debate it, to demonstrate that you hear the other person and that you care about how they felt, said Dr. Levy. Laughing about it doesn't hurt either. I turned my follies into a Twitter thread, which made other people laugh, which in turn made me feel better too. Exercise. Yes, it takes effort to get your workout clothes on when you already feel lousy, but quite a bit of research, including a 2015 review of studies published in Frontiers in Psychology, shows a single bout of exercise can boost positive feelings for a few hours afterward. However, that same review found data on reducing negative emotions was somewhat inconclusive. Tackle a challenge. Sometimes you just need a distraction. A hard puzzle or game can be the perfect antidote, says Dr. Barrett. When completed, the sense of accomplishment will further boost your spirits. Find a way to connect. Humans need to be around other people. We're social creatures, said Katrina Johnson Zimmerman, an urban anthropologist and an adjunct professor at Drexel University. Ms. Johnson Zimmerman studies behavior in public spaces and says that even micro interactions, like watching a rat pull a piece of pizza down the street with two strangers, enriches our lives. Most of us feel starved for that contact right now. Call a friend, do a video chat, or even just sit on your fire escape and wave at the person in the next building over. But skip the punching bag or scream session. Venting your anger may actually make you feel worse, said Lennis Echterling, PhD, a professor of psychology at James Madison University. Merely venting negative emotions by screaming or yelling does not have any health benefits, he said. And the research on the topic seems to point away from venting, diminishing our rage in any tangible way. Find what you're thankful for. A lot of things in the world are bad right now, but figuring out what you're thankful for can help you bounce back. Expressing gratitude for the people or things in our lives can help us feel more connected and inspired to help others, said Sonia Luya-Bominski, PhD, professor and vice chair of psychology at the University of California, Riverside, and author of The How of Happiness. It can also lift you out of whatever sent you into a spiral. It takes attention off you and directs it onto someone or something else, she said. The gratitude could be for small things, like getting a bag of coffee beans from your favorite roaster, or big things, like being safe and secure in your home. You can express this gratitude by telling another person what you're thankful for, about them or not, or by writing it down privately. However, gratitude needs to come from you. Don't ask for it from someone else. Just like telling someone to calm down inspires the reverse, telling someone why they should be thankful is most likely to inspire anger, not thanks. For example, if you're mad at your kids and someone tells you that you should be thankful for them, in that moment, I'm thinking, I know that I'm grateful for my kids. Don't tell me what to be grateful for, said Dr. Luba Barinsky. And if this is the thing that sets you off, well, take a breath and start over again. We'll move on to our last article for today. This comes from KevinMD.com, written by Jesse O'Shea, MD, and titled, Enduring the Pandemic, How to Support Your Friend on the Front Lines. Troubled by the volume of patients dying before they could even be taken out of ambulances, a New York emergency physician recently ended her own life. Are we all just vital statistics waiting to be calculated? COVID-19 has infected and killed more than 56,000 Americans. We must remember that every single one of these deaths is a loved one, a son or daughter, a father or mother, a husband or wife, a friend, a colleague. And in the background of each one of those deaths is a healthcare worker, a doctor holding the phone, allowing loved ones to say goodbye, a caring nurse holding the hand of the family cannot, a respiratory therapist ensuring they are breathing comfortably. And we all need your support. How are ya holding up? A friend texts me. I'm an infectious disease doctor caring for patients with COVID-19 in Atlanta hospitals. I'm doing all right, I think, I respond. All things considered, I get to work face-to-face with literal heroes every day while others are often alone in isolation, and my work is filled with a strong sense of purpose. Yeah, but didn't you sign up for this? Another friend teased. To be clear, 99% of healthcare workers did not sign up for disaster medicine. When entering the profession, most did not envision their days were going to be filled with fear, questioning their own mortality. Most did not envision days with bruises on their face from prolonged mask use. Two from my own team contracted the illness last week, leaving me with the anxious question, am I next? To be fair to my friend, I am part of a very tiny minority that did sign up for this line of duty. I studied communicable disease control and contagion prior to the outbreak. I have practiced in areas with turmoil before, and infectious disease has been my lifelong calling. But you should not and cannot assume this is true for others. Medicine changes you. Death changes you. Grief comes in waves. When I think about what I am seeing, the horrors of so many intubated patients suffering from multi-organ failure, the number of deaths, some of whom are young veterans, I cry. I can count on one hand the number of times I've cried in my adult life. One, when my parents died when I was younger. Two, when my brother died unexpectedly 5 years ago. Three, at the end of A Star Is Born, and four, when my other brother had his perfect daughter. Yet I can't help but get emotional at the COVID-19 images seared into my mind. The daily appreciation and acknowledgement I receive keeps me anchored. Some make me smile, while others unintentionally provoke stress. I write today to provide personal suggestions on how to support your friend or family member in the health workforce battling COVID-19. 1. Reach out, but with an expectation of short and simple conversation and often without a reply. Your goal is to let the other person know you are thinking about them and opening the opportunity to chat if they want to. Remember, many workers are feeling overwhelmed and may not respond immediately. If you don't get a response, try not to take it personally. Sometimes I won't respond until I'm off and have more energy, which can be days later. The messages I enjoy the most are ones that say something like, thinking of you, no need to respond, but am proud of you. Instead of expecting a reply, enjoy the thought that your message probably delivered a slice of happiness and perhaps made a difference in someone's day. 2. Use informal modes of communication. With the demanding schedule of pandemic work, phone calls can feel intrusive and possibly laborious, while emails seem impersonal and cumbersome. Instead, try reaching out via text message or Facebook. I know this affords me time to respond whenever I can and eliminates the feeling that you may have reached out at a bad or convenient time. 3. Avoid creating more work. After reaching out, try to shy away from asking pointed hypothetical coronavirus questions or clinical dilemmas. Questions like, when will this go back to normal? When can my grandparents visit my baby? Are tough to answer in general and may cause stress. Also, if you wish to send equipment donations, perhaps go directly to the hospital or through an organization, as coordination may require work. Items such as meals are appreciated as they save time cooking, but know it requires off time to accept. 4, don't assume we saw the news or a publication from 5 minutes ago. A new health policy test or treatment is approved every day. The environment is incredibly dynamic. Questions like, what are your thoughts of this, may seem benign at first, but require the healthcare worker to investigate further. In addition, we are not frontline reporters. I'm often asked, what is it like in the hospital or ICU? What's it like in your city? Being repeatedly asked these questions it asks me to relive my experience and may risk further trauma. I know these questions have good intentions, but ask yourself, why are you seeking these answers? Is the question to help the healthcare worker process their experience, or is it to address your own fear? 5, know we appreciate you. Medical professionals are likely to experience fear, anxiety, and a sense of powerlessness. We know how hard it can be to follow distancing protocols. It can feel like Netflix and chilling are insignificant in the pandemic world, but these protocols are one of the few methods we have to curb cases while we learn more about the disease. Your commitment is saving lives. And there we must stop today. Thank you for tuning in to Sound Body. Stay well and come back next week for more healthy living ideas.